Lights, camera, philosophy.
It's the Philosophy Talk Movie Show.
The first annual Dionysus Awards.
And the nominees are...
For Best Moral Dilemma, The Reader.
I have a piece of information concerning one of the defendants.
You don't need me to tell you. It's perfectly clear. You have a moral obligation to disclose it to the court.
For Best Epistemological Thriller, Doubt.
You haven't the slightest proof of anything.
But I have my certainty.
For Most Intricate Moral Maze, The Dark Knight.
The only sensible way to live in this world is without rules. And tonight you're going to break your one rule.
Join us as we explore the most philosophically interesting movies of the year.
Philosophy Talk's first annual Dionysus Awards.
Awards? They do nothing but give out awards. I can't believe it.
The Movie Show, coming up on Philosophy Talk
after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Everything except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, it's our first annual Dionysus Awards show.
The Dionysus Award will be given annually to the most philosophically interesting movies of the year. And also, whenever we feel like it, to philosophically notable movies from the past.
Does the world really need another movie award? I mean, we've already got the Oscars, the Golden Globe Awards, the National Society of Film Critic Awards, the People's Choice Awards, and many, many more. So, really, what's the point of another one?
Well, this one will be absolutely unique in the annals of film awards, Ken, because you and I get to decide who wins the awards. For another thing, it's just plain fun to look at movies through the lens of philosophy. Plus, until now, nobody has officially applauded movies for their philosophical merits. Our award, who knows, might motivate Warner Brothers and the rest of the great filmmakers to produce more philosophically interesting movies.
Don't hold your breath on that one.
Besides, what would you rather display on your mantle? An award named after the Greek god of wine, revelry, and theater? Or an award named after some guy named Oscar who nobody even remembers.
Well, that, you got a point there. So look, we better explain what we're up to, what we're looking for when we're handing out these Dionysus Awards. What makes a movie philosophically interesting?
Well, I can't give you a precise definition, but I could give you a lot of examples. Here's one. Lifeboat, released in 1944 at the height of World War II. It was the result of a somewhat dicey collaboration between two greats, Alfred Hitchcock, who directed it, and John Steinbeck, who wrote the first draft of the script, but later disowned the movie entirely.
I love Lifeboat. That's a pretty grim story, though. It's a story about this motley collection of people who they're from all different walks of life. They find themselves together on a lifeboat after the freighter they were all on gets torpedoed by a German submarine. I mean, they're stuck out in the middle of nowhere on this little lifeboat with no rescue in sight. Then, later on in the movie, they take on the captain of the German sub, too. And the movie's kind of about the, well, very complicated group dynamics among this motley crew.
Looks like they're all going to die out there for a while. Then, once the Nazi's on board, he takes over and things get better at first, but it's gradually revealed that he has a hidden agenda. Eventually, the others band together to overcome the Nazi captain.
Sounds like a gripping enough yarn, John, but what's philosophically interesting about it?
The film has many layers of meaning. On the surface, it's sort of an adventure survival story. Particular people, put to many tests, discover many surprising things about what they can and can't do. But at a deeper level, it's social and political allegory. It's about the nature of class struggle, racism, and ultimately about the then ongoing life and death struggle between democracy and fascism. It's about the horrible moral toll that war takes on us, even when it's justified and necessary.
Well, that justified and necessary part, that's what got Steinbeck ticked off. He thought Hitchcock made a pro-war film, and he had written originally an anti-war script, so that is it's a very complicated movie. I think you've hit on one of the hallmarks of a philosophically rich movie. They often have many layers of meaning that you can sort of unpeel layer by layer with the aid of a little philosophy. And my own favorite, one of my own all-time favorites in that connection is Memento, which is written and directed by Christopher Nolan. I think Nolan's one of the most intellectually ambitious filmmakers alive today.
We did a segment on Memento, Ken, on this program a few years ago, you remember. It's a great flick, very much worth examining through the lens of philosophy.
Well, you know, the one thing, though, there's not much surface about Memento. It's not much surface meaning. You're kind of thrown into the depths right away from the very first scene. That's because it's got this really dizzying narrative structure. It's got two stories, right? Two interlocking stories about the same character. One that unfolds forward in time and is shown in black and white, and then another one that unfolds backwards in time and is shown in color, so it's constantly flipping between these two narratives, and it's kind of very dizzying right up to the time when the two narratives merge and then are both in color.
Memento is the story of Lenny, a man who endures a severe head trauma during an attack that leaves his wife dead. The trauma leaves him incapable of forming long-term memories. He's trying to track down his wife's killer, but he can't remember anything for more than a short time. He has to use a series of external memories, notes, photographs, and tattoos to record information about himself and others, including his wife's killer.
And because he can't form long-term memories, he can't ever remember what these external aids are all about. And the viewers put in the pretty much the same situation. We don't know what all this stuff is about either, and we kind of have to piece it together bit by bit as the two narratives gradually unfold.
Both Lenny and the audience are engaged in a desperate struggle to make sense of Lenny, his situation, and his actions. It's quite a philosophically profound movie that digs deeply in philosophical themes about memory, perception, and the self. I like to use it when I'm talking about Wittgenstein and his private language argument. Sunk we'd be without memory and other people to help us.
Definitely. You could use it in lots of different contexts. Memento's a great movie. Lifeboat's a great movie. And, you know, we'll have to see if the movies from last year, from 2008, if any of them measure up to the high standards set by these two philosophical greats.
In a bit, Ken and I will be announcing our 2008 Dionysus Award winners. But unlike your average award show, we're eager to accept spontaneous suggestions right during the show from the floor, that is, our listeners. So join the fun by calling 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Rena Palta, went in search of philosophical reactions to one of this year's most highly acclaimed movies. She files this report.
At theaters around the country, and certainly around the San Francisco Bay Area, moviegoers are turning up for the same thing.
Hi, can I get two for Slumdog Millionaire?
It's going to be $20.
Slumdog Millionaire is a story about Jamal, a teenager from the slums of Mumbai who somehow becomes a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
It's getting hot in here.
Are you nervous?
What? Am I nervous? It's you who's in the hot seat, my friend.
Originally something of a sleeper film, Slumdog has been nominated for 10 Academy Awards. Critics love it, audiences love it, but for our purposes, one question remains about the movie. Is this a philosophical film?
Wow.
That's deep.
Well, there's the question of destiny, which I don't know if that's philosophical or not.
Fate or luck?
Well, I think the romantics will go with fate, won't they?
That's luck, but at the same time, it's almost like Calvinist predestination. You know, you have both facets of it there. He's destined for it in a way, but at the same time, he has to be himself and act in a way that brings him to that destiny.
These are absolutely philosophical things. So you have the good and the bad, right? The brothers who are divided between them.
Some moviegoers noticed philosophical themes from the movie in their own lives.
I also had a falling out with my brother, so my brother recently sort of bottomed out and realized that he had been pushing everyone away from himself and has sort of sought redemption.
Forgiveness and you know, do you forgive, do you not forgive, and is someone going to be worried or caring for someone just because they're a blood relative or even though that they've betrayed them.
The things that make good drama are the same things that make a life, where you have plot points that are good and bad. And, you know, most people don't understand that they are living out the Aristotelian plot curve all the time.
So what does Slumdog Millionaire teach us about what we think we know about ourselves?
The movie is sort of a commentary on the way in which assumptions about what being a genius means having a collection of relatively useless facts at your command or at your disposal, in this case, for the purpose of winning money. And versus knowledge being about self-knowledge. And I think there are a lot of knowledgeable and intelligent people in the world who constantly struggle to find that true knowledge of what will complete them and what will make them happy.
What it takes for love and for happiness and for success. And that's the great thing about stories and films like this, when it's universal and it plays into our hearts and our minds.
Film really is the closest to the poetics. And the purpose of the poetics is to help people be able to stand back and look at the major conflicts of their lives in a way that they could tolerate it.
The quest for self-knowledge, philosophy in itself, is what draws us to film. But maybe there's one other thing we get out of the movie-going experience.
Well, popcorn, it is movie theater.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Rena Palta.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're talking about the most philosophically interesting movies of 2008. We'd love to hear your suggestions. Which movies from 2008 did you find most compelling when viewed through the prism and filter of philosophy? And if no movies from 2008 strike your fancy, look back to the past and give us some older suggestions.
Join the fun. Help us find the winners of the 2009 Dionysus Awards. Give us a call at 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or email us comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've started a live blog entry so you can exchange views with folks from all over the world. Go to our blog at theblog.philosophytalk.org.
So, we just heard a lot about Slumdog Millionaire. Why don't we start there, John? It's a fine movie. I love many things about it. It's visually stunning. It's lyrical. I love its portrayal of how the life of the main protagonist is intertwined with the development of India. I love the little plot device that they use. And it's probably going to win Best Picture, or it's a front runner for Best Picture. But is it worthy of a Dionysus Award?
Well, first of all, I thought it was a great movie. Maybe my favorite movie of 2008. Secondly, all great movies have a philosophical element. Third, the people our roving philosophical reporter interviewed kind of reminded me of a lot of things that was in this movie that I didn't notice. But in the end, unless you think that there's some epistemological doubt about whether he was really fed the questions or not, and I don't think you're supposed to have that view, I don't see it as really having a focus on a philosophical theme.
Right. There's no particular philosophical theme that it helps you work through in any, I don't think, deep way. But still, I do love that movie. Now, there's another movie that's getting a lot of attention from the award ceremonies, and some critics really praise it for its depth and profundity. That's the Curious Case... Profundity. That's the Curious Case of Benjamin Button. You know, and this movie certainly has philosophical pretensions, but I'm going to ask you, do philosophical pretensions a philosophically compelling movie make?
Well, I think there's an apt comparison here with Memento, which we discussed before. Memento and Benjamin Button both have philosophically rich plots. The whole idea of aging backwards is really interesting. But Memento didn't knock you over the head with people telling you about the philosophy,
yeah, right.
and it was a disciplined movie. This is an undisciplined movie. They go on for 10 minutes about Cate Blanchett getting hit by a car, saying, we're a really important philosophy movie because we're going to tell you about the contingencies of life, and then the thing goes for 3 hours. My overwhelming emotion with this movie was annoyance.
You know, I kind of agree with you, and I do think it had potential, because that story, you know, the aging backwards versus the aging forward, that had potential, because every time you meet somebody in normal life and you travel a path, you're kind of traveling with them, you're aging with them, you're growing old with them. Benjamin Button's path keeps diverging from other people, and so you could make a movie about loneliness and our inability to connect and something like that. If you were thoughtful and reflective, you could turn that into a good movie, but I think this has ambitions, but it just doesn't. It doesn't deliver on those ambitions at all. So I'm no fan of this movie.
So we agree. Slumdog Millionaire, great movie, but not philosophical enough. Benjamin Button, philosophical enough, but not in a great movie. So neither of them gets an award.
Well, there you go. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking about the philosophically richest movies of 2008 as part of our first annual Dionysus Awards show.
Coming up, we'll take suggestions from the floor. That means from you, our listeners. And Ken and I will announce our opening two Dionysus Award winners in the categories of Best Moral Dilemma and Best Epistemological Thriller. Join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917. 1-800-525-9917.
The first Dionysus Award winners, plus nominations from the floor, via your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Dionysus.
You can never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star. Cause I can play the part so well.
This is Philosophy Talk, and we're giving out Dionysus Awards for the best philosophical films of 2008. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. What philosophically interesting movies have you seen this year? If nothing from the last year appeals to you, what are your favorite philosophical movies of all time? We'll be talking about our own picks in just a little bit, and we'd love to know if you agree or disagree with our suggestions.
I should give you the number, 1-800-525-9917. We're getting lots of calls. You can add to them, 1-800-525-9917, or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Before we get to this year's Dionysus Award for Best Moral Dilemma, let's hear from a regular contributor to the show, Allison Gopnik. She's professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. Allison, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hey, great to be back.
So what's on your mind there? What movie do you want to share with us?
I wanted to talk about a movie from a few years ago called Goodbye, Lenin. And the reason I wanted to talk about it is because it's a movie that talks about a philosophical dilemma that's associated with the relationship between children and parents. And I've been interested in a long time in the way that our nurturing of children raises philosophical dilemmas that are very deep and profound, but that haven't gotten paid very much attention to in philosophy.
Right, right. So tell us about the dilemma. Set it up just briefly for us.
So Goodbye, Lenin is a movie about a man whose mother is or at least seems to be a fervent socialist in East Germany. And she falls into a coma just before the end of the war, and when she wakes up, of course, the entire situation has changed, and East Berlin is no longer socialist. And in order to protect her, the son creates this fantasy that the world hasn't changed and that East Berlin is still the way it is. And then there are all sorts of twists about whether she's really being deceived by this fantasy or not.
Yeah, it's kind of like a brain in the vat thing, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
He's manipulating her perception of the world to make her believe that communism still stands.
And somehow, isn't it, the Coca-Cola company's ad kind of undermines the whole thing and makes it much more difficult, which is very much like real life, I think.
That's right. Well, it's a deep sort of metaphysical movie about what's real and what isn't. But for me, what's even deeper about the movie is something about the way that we tell truth and lies to children. So we all assume that truth is a great value and a good thing, and that part of our role as nurturers is to provide the truth to each other. And yet, when you're dealing with caring for another person, especially another person who's vulnerable like a child, you also have this sense of protection. In particular, we protect our children from the deepest truths about us, which is that we have sex and we die.
Except now it's the kid protecting the parent from the truth. And the excuse for protecting the parent is that she's had a heart attack and she's been in a coma for a long time and somehow can't handle the truth. But you think autonomous, self-governing adults are supposed to be able to handle the truth, aren't they? Especially since the communist regime was all about distorting the truth, you would think, why not have a pan to truth rather than a pan to the honorableness of deceiving your parent?
Well, I think that's what makes the movie so interesting, is that whenever we're caring for someone, part of caring for someone involves this tension between trying to introduce them to the truth. And again, the part of the plot is that it turns out that the mother has actually been deceiving the child through love at the same time. So part of what I think is so wonderful about this movie is the way that it shows that our affections, our close relationships, our attempts to nurture and protect the people that we love often put us in this dilemma about what to say that's true, when to tell the truth, and when to try to protect people from the cruelty and alienation that the truth often brings.
So, Goodbye, Lenin, a movie that, in my opinion, works on every level. It's the attempts to Fool the Mother are well conceived and often funny. The human relationships are well depicted, and the subtitles were good too. So if Ken agrees, we'll award this movie the best movie before 2008 philosophical thriller nominated by a brilliant psychologist.
There you go, Allison. So we love you. We love your pick, and we're going to give it a Dionysus Award. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Glad to be there.
Okay, we've got all kinds of callers on the line with all kinds of suggestions. Jonathan in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jonathan.
Well, thank you.
So what movie you want to share with us?
Well, for all time, one of my favorites is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original one.
That's the 1950 something, right? It was during the McCarthy era. It's been a long time since I've seen that movie. Remind us just really briefly.
Sure.
And then justify your pick.
Alien creatures come and invade Earth covertly. They're in pods, and they, one by one in the dark of night, they take over the bodies of people, and they act just like the actual people, but in fact they're sort of not the same. They're not the same people.
Okay, so why does this deserve a Dionysus Award?
Well, on one level, it's a horror film. On another level, it's about McCarthyism and how people sort of follow the herd, and you can't trust anybody, or you don't know quite who's on your side or who isn't. It's also about the generation gap, and you know, there's a great line where a little kid says, "My mother isn't my mother." And
a deep insight that all of us achieve. But Jonathan, thanks for a great suggestion. I that movie hadn't entered my thinking. It's a long time since I've seen it, but you make some very good points. I think if we get one more nomination for Invasion of the Body Snatchers, we'll have to invent a category and give it an award, Ken.
Okay, so that's what we'll do. And now we've got a caller on the line from Boston, Carol Barish. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Carol.
Ah, thanks for having me.
So what's your what do you want to share with us, Carol?
Well, I'd like to nominate Revolutionary Road. It's a darker film. It's quite emotionally intense. I think it really speaks to kind of classic philosophical interests about living one's best life, what a virtuous life is. It really raises all kinds of questions about the complexity of desire and fulfilling one's desire, and whether some people are more deserving of a better life than others, and if so, why?
Now, Carol, I agree with you that this movie, Revolutionary Road, raises all those questions. But, you know, I saw this movie, and it's an ambitious movie, and it's made artfully, but I despised it in a certain way. I despised its answer to this question, because the problem with it I saw was that they were constantly, the two lead characters, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, they were constantly blaming their unhappiness on externalities over which they represented themselves as powerless to change. And I just thought, oh, God, this thing is denying human autonomy. It's I don't know. What do you think?
I think you raised the good point, which raises the core question of which is, are they more deserving than others simply because they haven't demonstrated that they deserve anything more? And then if you want to ask that question, on what basis is anyone more deserving than anyone else?
But that's like something happens to you rather than something that you do. They just never took ownership of their life.
Exactly.
In the Titanic, these two same actors took ownership of their lives.
Yeah, but see, in a way, now, and Carol, you can correct me if I've got it interpreted wrong. I think Leonardo DiCaprio does take ownership of his life, because I think he was a fraud all along. I don't think he was interested in going to Europe. He was just playing a role to attract Kate Winslet. And so finally, when push comes to shove and he's got an opportunity to go, he realizes, no, I enjoy being an insurance salesman and having an occasional fling.
I think that's right, John. I think you're right. He takes ownership and she does it, and there's tragic consequences for their relationship in their not reconciling. But, Carol, it's a great it's a fine suggestion. I liked it as a movie. I wouldn't want to award it a Dionysus Award.
Well, how about Dionysus Award for the most interesting philosophical movie with Kate Winslet in it? Where she remains completely undressed through most of the film.
Well, I don't know. Well, thanks.
Completely dressed.
Honorable mention.
Yeah,
honorable mention.
Okay, we'll give it an honorable mention. Joining us. No, look, you can tell I'm no great fan of Revolutionary Road. Kate Winslet, though, does star in another movie released in 2008, of which I'm a great fan. That's The Reader.
And Ken, the winner of our first Dionysus Award for Best Moral Dilemma, goes to... The Reader!
So here's a brief thing about the movie if you haven't seen it. Go see this movie. A young man in post-World War II Germany starts an affair with Kate Winslet, who's about 15, 16, 17 years older than them. The affair lasts briefly. She suddenly disappears. Then he sees her again in courtroom. It turns out she's a defendant in the Nazi war crimes trial because she was a guard at Auschwitz during the war. And he comes to have this startling realization about her. There's a secret that's revealed. So, John, why The Reader for a Dionysus Award?
Well, I think it's a great movie. The way I see it, you've got several things going on. First, you've got the generational thing. The Kate Winslet character was born in 1922. The Michael character was born the same year I was, 1943. So you've got the generation of people who went through during their adult years World War II, living in Germany, and then you've got this next generation that grows up with this tremendous moral problem, understanding what their parents and the previous generation have done. Then you've got the and in the older generation you've got not just the Kate Winslet character. You've also got Michael's parents, and you've got the law professor, and that brings in the other thing, the social class thing. Obviously, the war and the war guilt and the direct experience of being recruited into a job where you guard Jews was a social thing, and the class is another big part of the movie.
You know, I read a review of this movie in the New York Times. I can't remember which of their reviewers found the movie morally repugnant. Morally repugnant because you're supposed to feel a deep sympathy for the Kate Winslet character, and you, in the end, think of her as some kind of victim. But she was a defendant in a Nazi war crime. I won't say whether she was guilty or not. But I think the movie is morally profound because there's a pressing question that she puts to the court during her trial. What would you have done?
Right.
And the movie has a very tough time answering that question on behalf of all the, quote, non-guilty Germans. I think it's very morally profound.
Exactly. I think that's the key point to the movie. She obviously is not a morally admirable person. She's not a heroine, but she is a sense of victim in the sense of this concept of moral luck. Inwardly, she's the same as a lot of other people that weren't put in her position, including not just the judge, but also the whole generation that came later. It's very easy, as the law students show, to get angry at the generation before, but what would they have done?
Right. We could talk about this movie for hours. I love this movie. It's The Reader. It's very morally profound. If you haven't seen it, go see it, and go see it again, because it's really rich. This is our first annual Dionysus Award show. We're talking about the most interesting philosophical movies of the year 2008, and we'd love to have your suggestions. But now it's time to announce our second Dionysus Award winner, this one for Best Epistemological Thriller.
And it goes to... Doubt.
Doubt stars Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's a priest. She's a nun. They work in this school together. She's the principal. She comes to suspect that he's making, let's say, illicit advances toward their first African-American student, a troubled young boy, and she sets out to either drive him away from the school or drive him out of the priesthood, and it's very intense. But why a Dionysus Award, John?
Well, I've seen this movie twice with different groups of friends, and it was interesting our different reactions. Is there any doubt? Is there any doubt that he was a molester? People disagree. And the review, it's just very interesting. My own reaction was I had no particular doubt that he was gay, but to me it was a very open question whether he had actually molested this child or not.
And it remains so to the... I mean, if you've seen this movie, some people think that the doubt is resolved at the end. I've seen this movie twice now. And the first time I thought that the doubt was resolved. But the second time I thought, no, it's not even close to resolved. And I don't want to give away the plot line, but there's two, to me, equally compelling interpretations of what happens and why it happens, and they're both completely standing at the end. One has to do with him being gay and taking an interest in this troubled boy for various reasons, mm-hmm. and the other has to do with him actually molesting this child, and they're equally there's nothing that prefers one interpretation over the other.
And a lot of interesting themes come out. The Meryl Streep character is caught within an institution in which won't support her in certain ways. But then there's this other institution, the institution of nuns, that she can rely on. Philip Seymour Hoffman character Scott is in an institution that he knows will support him in certain ways, but he's really frightened about something when he hears the nuns are going to be involved. So it's very fascinating. I understand that the doubt is a little more ambiguous in the stage versions, where there was a less overtop performance than Meryl Streep gave for the nun character.
Yeah, but I love this movie. We've got lots of callers who want to join this conversation. Richard in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Richard.
Hi.
Hi, what do you want to add to this conversation?
Well, first of all, I just have to say how much I love your program, and it's just hard for me to remember that it's moved to Sunday morning. Anyway.
That's a very important point. Let's make sure everybody got that. He loves our program.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Richard. What's your...
Yeah. I love the suggestions you've made so far, but one from history that has always moved me greatly. It's a movie...
You blanked out when you said the movie. I couldn't hear you.
Groundhog Day.
Okay.
And the reason it's so moving for me, and I watch it every Groundhog Day, is the notion of the perfectibility of humanity. This man can do it. He has to do it over and over, and then eventually somebody gets it right. Am I still on?
Yeah. we could give it a Nietzschean reading or a Nietzschean reading. I'm not sure which.
Because
he had this myth of eternal recurrence.
Right.
Maybe not Dionysus. Maybe Nietzsche.
Nietzsche admired Dionysus, too. But look, Nietzsche, the reason he said that, John said that, is because Nietzsche says, here's the measure of how well you've lived your life. Suppose that somebody at the end of your life would say, I'm going to give you this life again exactly as it was. And this person offers you your life again and again to infinity. Would you live your life over to infinity? If you say yes, you've lived well. If you say no, you haven't lived well. So Groundhog Day kind of, you know, it's the myth of the eternal return. And this guy lives his life well eventually.
I think it's the best and most philosophically interesting movie ever made that uses a groundhog to illustrate Nietzschean point of view. And we should give it an award for that.
There we go. The Dionysus Award for Nietzschean point of view. So we've got another caller on the line, Fern in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Fern.
Hi.
What's your comment or suggestion?
I agree, Groundhog Day was great, and I know you're asking for movies from this year, but can I, too, nominate a movie from the past?
Absolutely.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Oh. Gosh, that's the Diane Keaton movie, right? Is that Diane Keaton?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was so timely, but it's timeless because it would apply now. Everybody leads a double life. And it was a true story. It was a true story about a... have either of you...
I saw this movie. This is a movie from the 80s, right? Or something like that. Or is this the 70s?
70s.
Yeah, it's been a while. I don't remember it very well. Just, can you remind me in brief?
Okay, real briefly, the Reader's Digest condensed version.
Two sentences.
A woman raised in a very rigid, strict Catholic home is a teacher of deaf students during the day and goes bar hopping at
night.
Now, you understand, have to understand, in the 70s, I don't know, you know, just about the whole world did that and didn't even know the name of the person that was came home with that.
Fern, I'm going to have to... I'm remembering this movie now. It's a fascinating movie. I'm not sure if it wins a Dionysus Award, but that's mainly because it's not very fresh in my mind. But I'm going to take another look at it and refresh my memory of this movie. Thanks so much for your suggestion. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're taking a philosophical look at movies of 2008 for our first annual Dionysus Awards.
We've talked about a lot of different films so far. There's lots more to come. In our next segment, we'll accept more suggestions from the floor, and we'll announce our final Dionysus Award winner for moral complexity. We'd love to know if you think there's anything that Ken has missed or something he's gotten wrong, and I suppose me too. The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Suggestions from the floor and so much more when Philosophy Talk continues.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Open the pod bay doors, pal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
You talking to me?
What you got to say?
You talking to me?
Play it one step.
What you got to say?
Play as time goes by.
Life was like a box of chocolates.
Here's Johnny.
We're taking a philosophical swing at Hollywood, Bollywood, and all the independents out there. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. It's the Dionysus Awards, and we're talking about the most philosophically compelling movies of 2008.
Before we get to our final Dionysus Award winner, we're going to hear from another friend of the show, Josh Landy, professor of French at Stanford University. He has a favorite philosophical movie. Okay, Josh, what is it?
Actually, before I get to my nomination, I just want to mention something in connection with The Eternal Recurrence, a great line from Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters.
Okay.
He says, Nietzsche says we're going to live the same life over and over again. Great. That means I'll have to sit through the ice capades again. It's not worth it.
There you go. Okay, Josh, what's your pick?
My nomination is Adaptation by Charlie Kaufman.
Oh, yeah? Why? I mean, that's a fine movie. I like that movie a lot. Tell us a little bit more about it and why it's worthy of a Dionysus Award.
Okay, so this movie, it's a little hard to summarize, but you have a character playing Charlie Kaufman, the author of the screenplay, and he's trying to adapt the book, The Orchid Thief, into a Hollywood film.
Which is a real book.
Which is a real book, but it's a book about flowers.
Yeah.
And the question is...
a thriller about flowers.
How could you make a movie about flowers? And there's the philosophical part of it, I think, is the question behind that question, which is why would you want to? Why would you even want to make a movie?
Well, the movie has an answer to that, because these flowers, orchids, are pursued by these orchid hunters, right? All over Florida, but apparently lots of different places. And they're dying to find just that one flower. It's about passion and desire and all that, right?
Right, but there's not enough there. There's not enough there for the film, and that's the predicament of this character, is trying to adapt the book into a movie. And my sense about it is that there's an implicit premise, which is that we... today are obsessed with narrative. We're just obsessed with these narrative phenomena. We're living in the age of the makeover.
Right, right.
I think that goes for philosophy, too. If you think about recent theories of selfhood, they tend to be narrative theories of selfhood.
We're obsessed with telling stories.
Right.
A less fancy way of saying what you just said is we're obsessed with telling stories.
Right.
Shouldn't we be obsessed with telling stories? Human life, human history is all about the unfolding of stories, right?
No. I mean, yes and no, right? Yeah, sure, stories are very important, but stories don't cover the full range of phenomena. There are certain phenomena that live outside of storytelling time, and flowers are one of those phenomena.
Well, so you... John, you want to...
Well, no, I was just going to say, I thought this was a fine movie. It had questions of identity and all sorts of things, and the acting was terrific. But one of the things I liked best about it was Chris Cooper, because he's one of my favorite actors.
Yes.
And that reminds me of my favorite Chris Cooper film, which is Lone Star, a John Sayles film, which we probably should have given an award to some kind for. But is there going to be a movie about Remembrance of Things Past, your favorite book? Is somebody working on that?
There already is. There are a couple of films, and they're not very good, I'm sorry to say.
Ah, too bad.
But you and I could make one.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay.
Ken can provide the funding.
Yeah, right. So, Josh, thanks a lot for joining us. Okay, so we've got more callers on the line. Jewel in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jewel.
Yes, howdy. Good morning, Ken, John. Like your show. I've just been watching the last few days the Apu trilogy. Satyajit Ray started in 19... It's a series of movies made from 1955 through 1959. I think there's a lot of poetry and a lot of philosophy in these. It's pretty deep, I think. It's the second time I'm watching them.
I'm going to have to take your word for that. I haven't seen any of them. Have you seen any of these?
No, I haven't.
Satya Ajit Ray.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to take these on advisement and look them over myself.
I'm definitely going to take your word and put it on my list for next year's watching.
Okay, we've got, thanks for the call. Chris in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Hi, I want to nominate a film from the past, and that's from the 50s. It's called Rashomon. It's by Kurosawa.
Oh, yeah. Great movie.
And with Toshiro Mifune, and it concerns the sexual assault told from the vantage point of the three people involved. And I think it's both epistemologically and morally interesting. Both because it leaves the viewer wondering what really is the truth. What is and beyond that, what is truth in general? How do you determine what truth is?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a great movie. It's a great movie. And if we were giving out best epistemological thriller of all time, it probably would be the best epistemological thriller of all time. So thanks.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It gave rise to a whole genre of Rashomon-style movies, but it's still the best.
So let's go back to Josh Atlantis' Kaufman nomination, because he's certainly a fine writer and filmmaker, and he's deeply philosophical. We actually did a Philosophy Talk Goes to the Movies segment on another film of his, The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So John and I are really big fans of Kaufman.
And Kaufman has another film out last year that one of our listeners, Bailey Haikawa from San Francisco, thinks is deserving of a Dionysus Award. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bailey. Tell us about your pick.
Hi. Okay, well, it's the kind of movie that you really almost can't describe in words.
Yeah.
You know, but it is just so experimental and surreal makes so much sense.
What's the name of the movie, Bailey?
Oh, okay, good. It's called Synecdoche.
Synecdoche.
Synecdoche, yeah. New York, right?
Synecdoche, New York, which is a play on the words of Schenectady, which is funny because I think most people get intimidated by the movie because they don't really understand what that word is or how to say it, you know.
Yeah, that's when a part of something represents the whole kind of thing. You take a part of something, yeah, right, to represent, stand for the whole thing. So, you know, the guy with the chicken sandwich. Well, the chicken sandwich is representing the whole guy or something like that.
You know, Bailey, this movie frustrates me because I didn't get to it when it was in the theaters, and it hasn't come out on disc, and I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either, although I wanted to see it. It just came and went so fast.
It's in an awkward stage right now,
yeah,
but it is just a must experience.
I feel the need to see this movie. I'm dying to see this. Kaufman is one of my favorite film writers, and this is his first movie he directed, so I'm dying to see this movie. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to give it a provisional Dionysus Award.
So,
waiting to see. So thanks for the suggestion, Bailey. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Folks, as you can see, our Dionysus Awards are somewhat more flexible than the Academy Awards. You know, the Academy Awards are philosophical, too, in that the word academy comes from Plato's Academy. That's where we got the word. So philosophy, no matter what route you go through movies, you end up with philosophy. Our final Dionysus Award is for moral complexity, and it goes to The Dark Knight.
So look, I know that some people don't like this movie, some people on our very own scene, but I love this movie. It's written and directed by one of my favorites, Christopher Nolan, who also wrote and directed Memento that we talked about. It's Batman versus the Joker in the dark, crime-ridden streets of Gotham, but this isn't your average Saturday matinee superhero movie by a long shot. It's got all the, you know, requisite pyrotechnics and special effects, but it's this dark and brooding meditation on the nature of heroism and the limits of human virtue. John, what do you think? I know you have a slightly different take.
Well, I you're going to have to explain why it's philosophically rich enough, but I certainly believe you. But my first I had two initial reactions. The first one is, this is like playing a video game with my grandchildren. There's so much going on. It's so complex. Cards crashing. I can't keep straight of the events, of the narrative. I mean, it just makes me feel old, inadequate, and mentally slow.
But, you know, the thing is, it's really deep because it really shouldn't. It's really not a Batman movie. It's a Joker movie. And the Joker is an amazing character. Albert says at one point, some men just like to see the world burn. That's the Joker. And then the Joker says, rules? We don't live by rules. I'm going to shake up your rules. I'm moral chaos. And that's what the movie is. What the Joker does is constantly, constantly put everybody to the test. He kind of takes Gotham hostage and experiments with it morally and see what people will do. He just wants to see how they will behave, what their moral limits are. And some people reach their moral limits and break, and some people withstand. This moral test.
I like the Joker character. I mean, he was just interesting in his motivation, because you couldn't understand it, but it was true to it. The district attorney character I didn't quite believe. But one question haunts me about this film. I think it haunts all of San Francisco. Where's Robin? Where's Robin? Is Robin buried in the underneath the floor of the Wayne Mansion?
Yeah.
I mean, once Bruce decided he was a heterosexual, did Robin just have to go? Where is Robin?
Well, Robin doesn't appear in this movie, but a lot. I just want to see. So there's a prisoner's dilemma. There's people like, either you push the button and destroy all the people over there, or they push the button and destroy all the people over there. And if neither of you pushes the button, I'm going to destroy you all. But people rise to the occasion. There's an innocent man. They say, unless you kill this, he makes an experiment. Unless you kill this guy, I'm going to blow up a hospital. Some people try to kill the guy. Some people, and Batman himself almost breaks his own rules to stop. He doesn't know what to do to stop the Joker. He just doesn't know what to do. And so he gets to the limits of his moral abilities. So I think it's a really profound movie.
The Prisoner's Dilemma is when a prisoner can get an advantage by turning the other guy in and vice versa, but they're both better off if neither of them does it, and they're both worse off. I think it's a great movie. Any movie that ends up with a prisoner's dilemma involving two ferry boats deserves a Dionysus Award. Maybe we have some more callers then. But we've got, by the way, email suggestions are Frozen River, Waltz with Bashir, The Escapist, and The Conversation so far.
Well, so they've got lots of – we don't have time to talk about all of those. You want to take one final last caller? Just one, Tim, you're the last one. Tim in Sonoma, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, yeah.
Just very briefly.
Hi, yeah. This would be I've Loved You So Long.
I don't know. Another movie I haven't seen.
A French film with an American actress. I can't even really tell you what her name is. But in terms of moral complexity, I think this eclipses doubt in my mind. And also in terms of subtlety of portrayal and acting, I think it's wonderful. It's in terms of the self-sacrifice by the main character. So it's basically a story of a woman who comes out of prison who was a notorious case 20 years before having killed her young son, and her sister taking her back into her home, and the repugnance of people around, suspicion and so forth. And then finally, through the film is revealed the moral, the truly, in a sense.
I've heard a lot of good things about this film. It's definitely on my list. It stars Kristen Scott Thomas. I'm going to try to see it soon. Thanks so much, Tim.
So we'll put all these suggestions. We got tons of suggestions. We'll put them up on our webpage. We'll put something about our views about them, and you can all take a look and have a rich diet of movies to see. We'll put them on our webpage. We'll mention them on our blog.
You can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For our final word, we're going to turn to this year's winner for Fastest Philosophy on Radio. Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, here are some so-called good movies that I did not much care for. 2001 A Space Odyssey bored the hell out of me. Then my friend said, no, you have to see it stoned. So I did, and then I was bored and stoned. Bad combination. Eyes Wide Shut. Well, nobody liked that movie, I guess, though I was slightly amazed at how Kubrick could make an orgy seem dull. Nashville. A bunch of people wander around, do stuff, then one of them gets killed for no apparent reason. The end. Shortcuts. A bunch of people wander around, do stuff, and then an earthquake suddenly happens. The end. Citizen Kane. Orson Welles seemed more interested in his own cleverness than his subject. Cries and Whispers. The scene in which Ingrid Tulin mutilated her genitals with broken glass. Well, the movie kind of lost me after that. Vertigo. If you're going to kill your wife, would you make up some cockamamie story about her being the reincarnation of a suicidal woman who died 100 years ago? Then hire somebody to pretend to be your wife, take a chance that a mentally unstable detective would fall in love with her, and bring your real wife to a bell tower on the same day as the cop and the wife's ringer, who is wearing the exact same outfit as the wife somehow, and take the further chance that the cop would not overcome his fear of heights and come to her rescue, or failing that, take the chance that the cop would not look at the body and see immediately it was a different woman? Wouldn't you, just push your wife down a flight of stairs and tell the cops she tripped? Of course, you wouldn't have a convoluted movie then. Great performance by James Stewart, though. Happiness. Imagine the most vile thing a character can do in any given situation, and then watch that character do it. American Beauty. There was not one thing in this movie that did not ring false, especially the repressed homosexual, homicidal marine collector of Nazi memorabilia. A lot of those in suburbia, are there? Sideways. Two creeps drink wine for a couple hours, I think. I only made it through the first 20 minutes. Oh, and The Dark Knight. I know you all just discussed this movie, but I'm compelled to throw in my 2 cents worth, or maybe just 1 cent worth. Should a movie about a guy who dresses like a bat so he can fight crime be grim and depressing, and 2.5 hours long, with fight scenes so clumsily staged and dimly lit you can't always tell who's fighting who? I vote no. And don't get me started on Crash. Really, don't. Close the pod bay door, Hal. I gotta go.
Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merrill Kessler, Corey Goldman, Jennifer Jensen, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.